Welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast with Craig Hewitt and Dave Rodenbaugh. This is a podcast documenting the journey as self-funded business founders and sharing lessons, tips, and tricks for businesses following the same path as ours. The journey is long and winding, but we're glad you're joining us for it. And now it's time to go rogue with Dave and Craig.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast. I am flying solo today, but I have a very exciting guest here, Kurt Elster of EtherCycle, who is a Shopify and e-commerce expert. He's got some great knowledge bombs to drop. And even though you might be thinking to yourself, Dave, I'm not in e-commerce. Why do I want to listen to this guy? You need to listen to this guy. He's got some great information about conversion rate optimization and ways to optimize your site and experiences that he's had that would definitely apply for any type of a site, not just e-commerce. So, Kurt, tell us a little bit about yourself today.
Thank you for having me. My honor and pleasure.
Awesome. Awesome. So, tell me a little bit about yourself here and what you do.
So, for the last several years, I'm now a Shopify Plus expert. I have hitched my cart to their horse. I eat, breathe, sleep Shopify. And predominantly my work is based on conversion rate optimization, revenue optimization, looking for low-hanging fruit in existing stores and helping stores make more money, right? That's the end outcome. But I do it specifically for Shopify. Though any of these lessons really apply to any e-commerce platform and to any, and then from there, really, you know, there's just a lot of valuable info in regards to like online sales.
Hitching your cart. I see what you did there.
Yes.
Very nice. All right. So how did you get started in all of this? I mean, Shopify has not been around, you know, a long time from the internet perspective. So how did you figure out that Shopify was the place to be?
All right. So here's my origin story. The quick version of the origin story. In 2009, I was working 2008, 2009, I was working as a e-commerce product manager for an e-commerce dropshipper. And I started, one day I just got up and went to tie my shoes and I just started crying. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And it's not their fault. I don't have the personality to have a boss. So I said, yeah, I'm going to quit my job. Gave a 7-day notice. It seemed a little unusual. And I didn't have a plan. And then a day later in the shower, I thought, you know what? I'm going to start my own e-commerce platform. Didn't know what I was getting myself into. Just shot for the moon. And had a good childhood friend who had been laid off as he was a talented front end developer. And I'm like, yeah, it's close enough. He could build this for me. so we partnered. And a year later, discovered we didn't know what we were doing. And to keep the lights on, I started building brochure sites for local businesses. And like the first one was like $500. And then I got $700. And by the time I got to $2,500, I thought it was like some kind of criminal act. And from there, we worked our way up the ladder. And quickly found ourselves working for creative agencies. So we're the low man on the totem pole, but we're building custom WordPress themes for big brands, which really, like, I will pull back the curtain. It's the same work you would do for a brochure, you know, the small brochure site as you would do for the large site fundamentally. So we did stuff for like Verizon, the NFL, Hilton Hotels. And at the same time, I had a friend locally who owned a bike shop. He said, I want to sell online, build me a store. Again, I was shooting for the moon. Our very first Shopify project, I said, let's try this thing called Shopify. Why not? It seems easy. And he didn't want anything complicated. So we did it. And we did an entirely custom design and developed theme. Shopify took notice. And they said, we're going to make a thing called the Experts Program. It's like an app store, but to find help. And you made a custom theme. Do you want to be in it? I said, why not? Throw me in there. You know, just said yes to whatever came along. And then I got a couple leads through there. And we're still doing the agency work. And one day I wrote an actual sales letter and put that up on my Shopify Experts listing. Then I started getting lots of leads and they were better qualified. And I said, at the end of every Shopify project, we would go, wait, why am I, this is like, that was easy. And really it wasn't that it was easy, it's that we were good at it. It's what we enjoyed doing. So I said, why don't we only do e-commerce? And like with 3 months after that, I said, wait, why are we doing anything but Shopify? And that was 3 years ago now.
Very cool. Very cool. So, gosh, you know, so much has changed in Shopify during that time and just e-commerce in general. You know, what would you say has been one of the toughest things about riding the wave with Shopify so far?
Well, I think, you know, well, for me personally, geez, it has been phenomenal. I don't know what the most difficult part for me, I really couldn't say. the most difficult part for e-commerce merchants in general is it's no longer this wide blue ocean where you could just build a store and people show up. Like it's too competitive. And at this point, the most important part is building an audience, building a list, getting people engaged. Because if you build it, they won't come, is what a lot of people discover the hard way. Or they've got like a really exciting idea. They do it. They build the store. They get the perfect design. And they're like, I'm going to launch it. Like, or what's your launch plan? They're like, well, I'm going to take the storefront password off. And that's it. You know, and then no one shows up. And they go, okay. And then they discover, wow, building traffic's really hard.
This sounds surprisingly like those that want to launch just a new business in general.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A store is obviously no different. You've got to have an audience. You've got to tap into a need. You've got to find a way to reach them. You've got to, you know, market well and promote yourself and give them a reason to keep coming back. Yeah.
So and that's the hard part. Yeah. That's the thing that everybody overlooks.
Right, right. Absolutely. So let's get back to your Shopify consulting here for a second. So let's say a client is coming to you and they want to improve conversions in their Shopify store. So where do you start with that? I mean, it seems like such a huge thing. What kind of questions do you ask?
Yeah, there's so many. There's such a variety of things there. And oftentimes it'll start with like, well, what's a good conversion rate? Because this is mine. And you can't, like, number one, you can't compare conversion rates just as you really couldn't compare like revenues between stores because they're so different. You know, it's a different store, it's different marketing, different customers, different products, et cetera. So I look at, you know, hey, number one, truthfully with conversion rate optimization, the number one factor in your conversion rate is going to be the quality of traffic. Where is it coming from, right? Like the stores that have double digit conversion rates, it's because their traffic is all primed in some way where they send them usually from like an article, you know, they get most of their traffic from some like really amazing positive review, that kind of thing. And then they run Facebook ads against that. But in like thinking of traditional conversion rate optimization, right? Most of the time I can just walk through a store with fresh eyes and pick out all these barriers and friction points to purchasing. Because you as the store owner, and this happens to anyone with a website, you spend more time on your own website than anybody else, right? So you quickly become blind. You can't see the forest through the trees. And there's like weird issues about your site that you're just used to. You don't think about it. So having just a fresh pair of eyes go, okay, here's like every friction point and let's fix those things. Like that alone could double the conversion rate because they're, you know, on a website, people are rightfully lazy. They should expect good experiences. And your biggest competitor ends up being the back button.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was listening to, I don't remember if it was one of the articles that you had written or a podcast episode, but I thought, yes, I was just like screaming as soon as I saw that. I'm like, yes, that's your biggest competitor right there. Oh my God. Yeah. Everybody's like, oh no, it's so-and-so. No, it's the back button. It, like everybody is like, as soon as they find the first barrier or the frustration, they're like, fuck this, I'm out of here.
Yeah. And yeah. They should be like that. I mean, why should they put up with anything else? So the tenet we follow is we assume the user is a crazy, lazy drunk. Okay? By crazy, we mean we think they're a narcissist. You know, too many new websites I see suffer from iuria, where it's just like, I do this and I do that. No, I don't care about you. I care about me, right? So make all your copy you focused. Make it focused on the customer and the benefit that you're going to give them, how you're going to give them superpowers with your product. That's number one. That solves the crazy part. Lazy. They're not like, if you make it at all difficult to find your product, you can't put any kind of unnecessary burden on them. They're not going to be interested. And then drunk, just make the site as easy to use as possible. If I can use this site, you know, four microbrews in, then it's going to work for somebody who's sober. So if you design with that, those three ideas in mind, the site's always going to be easy to use and compelling for, you know, the majority of people, for your ideal customer.
Yep. Yep. There was a UX thing that we used to talk about years ago that was like, if your mother can't use the site, then it's not a site that is well optimized at that point. But it's basically the same thing. It's not that my mom is crazy, lazy, or drunk, which is not the thing to say right after Mother's Day, right?
Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day. No, but it's the same sort of principle. Like if it's not simple enough, if it's not clear enough, if it's not focused enough that your own mother can't figure out what they should be doing on there, then you probably don't have things set up quite right yet. So it's the same kind of deal, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's say you know, a merchant is interested in making conversion rate optimization stuff here. So where should they actually start? I mean, there's tons of different places on the e-commerce site, you know, the physical cart itself, the product detail pages, category pages, the homepage of the site, landing pages. I mean, like where do they go?
So good question. You know, you can ideally in any of these situations, you want to try to make data driven decisions just to kind of remove the emotion from it, to be more informed and to try and do less uninformed guesswork. Like I ultimately, and this is true of most sites, the original design is probably based on uninformed guesswork. It's a best guess, but until you put it out there and watch how people use it, you really have no idea. So what we could do, most things, you know, so in Shopify in particular, you could see what your sales funnel looks like. You can see, all right, what percent add to cart, what percent reach checkout, what percent purchase. And if you look at those numbers, a good benchmark would be each number should be half of the previous number. So if I've got a 1% conversion rate, I would expect 2% to reach checkout. I would expect 4% to add to cart. So, all right, looking at those numbers, if one is like way out of skew, then you know roughly like in between there is where the problem came in. So that's where you could start to look. That's one good way to do it. Another would be to do some shoulder surfing. Have someone who's never purchased from your store before, you know, a friend, a family member, anybody. You just get like two people. It would be informative. Have them walk through the store and try to purchase something. And keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything. It will be the most frustrating thing in the world to watch. And take notes at like what problems they have and where they get caught up. And then try to figure out, you know, take responsibility for it. Go, all right, I screwed this up. I designed this wrong. We did this wrong. And then fix those problems. And if you want to get fancy, you know, you could do the same thing with heat mapping. I love heat mapping. I use Hotjar for heat mapping. But I quickly found just having a store owner do heat mapping doesn't really do them much good because they don't know how to interpret the results. So that's why it's probably better just to watch the shoulder surfing. Watching someone do it is better.
Yeah. I've looked at heat map results and tried to interpret what's going on there. And it seems like there could be multiple ways to figure that out. And ultimately, I felt like heat map interpretation is so subjective that
yes, it is.
You could totally take the wrong tactic on that one. So the shoulder surfing tactic is awesome. I know another guy that actually does this. Do you know Ben Orenstein from Thoughtbot?
I'm not familiar, but that doesn't mean anything.
Well, yeah, he does a little, he's done a variety of things, but the one thing that he does is this little, sort of like the Twitter of podcasting. It's called briefs.fm. And so he did this little onboarding setup on here and he was testing the whole thing. And it basically was, you know, he thought he had created this easy to use, super, super quick, super intuitive onboarding process, put it in front of a user, did screen sharing while they were doing it, and was amazed at every single place that they ran into a barrier. And then he thought, okay, well, I'll just throw in more text or I'll do this or I'll do that. And then you go through another onboarding again and they kept hitting the same barriers. And then finally he realized he just had to redesign it. And it wasn't until he had done that shoulder surfing that he would have figured that out. If he had done any of the other traditional ways to do this, he would have just run into a brick wall and then given up and said, oh, this just doesn't work. But that's not true. He didn't understand what his customers were struggling with. So.
Right. That initial design was okay. It was an uninformed best guess. And I'm sure he knew what he was doing. So I'm sure it was a good product and made sense, but it made sense to him, right? Until you get it in the hands of your customers, it really doesn't matter what you do with it. Yeah. Actually doing a screen share. That's very clever. I like that idea.
Yeah. It's easier. Like shoulder surfing where you have to physically be in the same room with the user. That can be pretty tough, but screen sharing in this day and age is actually pretty easy. So I thought that was a clever solution too.
Yeah. I like that. Uh-huh. Noted.
Noted. Yeah. So there you go. Add something to your toolbox there. So talking a little bit more about conversion rate optimization, you know, e-commerce has shifted quite a bit in the last 2 to 3 years to where mobile is now, you know, important, not just for e-commerce, but for everybody. How would you say that your conversion rate optimization strategies have changed now that everybody's thinking mobile first?
That's a good point. So, you know, with mobile, it becomes even more important because it's harder. I think it's harder to navigate on your phone. Like having competing calls to action becomes a problem. We've got a much, much lower screen real estate. Pay load times become a big deal. You want to really simplify things for mobile. I think it's very easy to scroll on mobile. So having, you know, longer pages, I think still works on mobile. But number one, I would look at usually the biggest barrier, and this one's hard to track and figure out, is load time, right? It's not uncommon where we see like Shopify stores where, you know, someone has just been a little sloppy, a little careless with uploading images and you have like a 12 meg homepage all of a sudden, or you added too many apps and you get these big bloated homepages. On a desktop connection, you know, I'm in a major city, I got good broadband, a 12 meg site is fine. It'll just load. I won't even feel it. But on a mobile phone, like I'm on my phone in the US, 3 megabit is by the US government defines as broadband. 3 megabit is basically useless. And even like on a phone, even if I'm in a major city, okay, let's say I'm in Chicago, I get on the blue line, I'm on the subway. The moment that thing goes underground, I'm now on like the poorest 4G connection ever. So those load times on mobile become hugely important to your conversion rates.
So is there a specific tool that you have people use to try to test their mobile stuff? So like I've usually used things like PageSpeed or YSlow off of the console.
Yeah, if you wanted to get fancy, there are tools out there that will throttle your connection so you can try and go through a site on a really slow connection. Usually I don't do that. What I look for is YSlow is good. I like that a lot. But I just use the inspect tool in the browser in Chrome on the network tool. And it'll tell you like, okay, here's the load time. Here's render time and all that. And generally you want to shoot for, all right, A, get this page as small as possible. You will get benefits from it. But like 2.5 megs seems to be, I mean, I'd love it to be like 500K, but I mean, sites just get so big now that like 2 megs is probably what you should be shooting for. Just yeah. Go for like a target page size.
Mm-hmm. I know that Google always complains about my page sizes after they get above a certain point, but you know, that 2 meg sounds much more reasonable, especially when you have an e-commerce store where it's just so image heavy right on those pages, right?
Right. You've got, you know, there's all kinds of snippets and apps and stuff installed. And then you've got, you want big images and then maybe you're streaming video. Cause video really does, it helps boost conversion rates. And those, you know, when I go buy something in a store, I could touch it, feel it, see it, smell it, you know, try it on. Online, you don't have any of that. So you have to try and make up for it with lots of media. And then that's where things get out of control.
Sure. Sure. So getting back to the way that people are working on their sites right now, what would you say are some design and maybe messaging mistakes that you see merchants making all the time?
So like the most typical issues I see in e-commerce stores, you know, number one, we don't get to explaining what the heck we're doing fast enough. Like when I land on the homepage, I don't want to read a whole long about page to try and figure out what it is you do. It is not my job to figure out what you do. Ideally, within 5 seconds, I want to know what it is. So one really easy trick that people miss out, like you want to add lots of cues to these things. So, you know, in the US, we read in an F pattern. So we're always going to start at the top left of the screen. So easy trick here, put your logo up there, right? You got your logo. And then under it, put a 3 to 5 word tagline that just real quick hit describes, you know, tries to describe what you sell or what the benefit is or who it's for. Just something to say, okay, I'm on the right spot. I'm in the right place and this is for me. You know, we don't have to chase everybody. We just have to chase our ideal customer. So adding that tagline under the logo is just such an easy optimization. You know, there's no reason you not to do it. Anybody can do it. Really great for mobile where you've got this limited screen real estate. Like that's such a good one. I love that. And then another quick like professional or indicator of professionalism and trust is get a toll-free number. And toll-free number is kind of silly in that like there's no such thing as long distance calling anymore. And that's what toll-free numbers got you out of was a long distance call penalty. But a toll-free number says, hey, we're a real company, we're professional, and we're available. If you need to, you can call us. And that like that busts an objection that people might have. So like those are just above the fold. As soon as the page loads, those are two things I want to see. I want to see a logo with a tagline. I want to see a toll-free number.
Nice, nice. I didn't think about the tagline being quite so important there, but the way that you've stated it, I think that, you know, especially on mobile, when there's just so little to see at a time on the screen, that you've really got to convey what the heck is this all about quickly and get them engaged. And, you know, a picture with a cute logo and a name doesn't necessarily do that, but the tagline really does. So, yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
And then, yes, because as soon as I load that page, all I need the site to do is just give its sole job as soon as it loads, that masthead, is just get them to scroll down the page. That's it. That should be its only job, right?
Yeah.
So those are, I think, two great ways, two just quick, easy ways anybody can use to go about that. And then as they scroll down, most sites are going to go into a carousel slider. I hate your carousel slider. 90% of people are only
everybody hates the carousel. Yeah. Oh God. Oh.
And yet they're still there. I still see them. It's less so like we're preaching. We'll get rid of them eventually. But no, I mean, that's such an easy way to reduce load time is get rid of the other slides, because 90% of people are only ever going to see the first one. And on there, put a quick, an easy call to action. So a good example of this is everestbands.com, the Shopify store we worked on that sells replacement watch straps for Rolex. This is a good working example of all this stuff in practice. And they have a single hero image in what would normally be a slider. And it's got three huge words on it. It says, customize your Rolex. Ah, okay. So we have in three words said, this is for people who own a Rolex, right? There's our target market. And the outcome is you get to customize your watch by adding a fancy strap to it. Cool. And then our call to action is a big green Rolex green button. Okay, not quite Rolex green button for trademark reasons, that has an obvious call to action, which is select your watch. So every page's job is just to get us to the next step. So the first thing is, hey, let's pitch you, this is who we are. We're professional. We're real. And if you own a Rolex and you want to customize it, you're in the right place. Conveyed all that in three words with a picture. And then we've got three words as our call to action. Select your watch. Okay. So now we're going to bucket people to get them to the right product as fast as possible. This is such a great optimization trick. Is the faster, if you want to increase the percentage of people who purchased, get more people to add to cart, right? So if you get more people to add to cart, how do you do that? Well, just get them to the product as fast as possible. So that's why we bucket them into, our first thing is not learn about the company, learn why. No, it's tell us which watch you have so we could show you the products for you. So we say, select your watch. And these are just categories. It's like, all right, pick, you got your Rolex Submariner, you click it. Now it's just going to show you only the products that are relevant to you in one collection. You can just scroll down the page, see all of them in one spot, pick a product. And now we're on a long form sales page, a product page turned landing page with lots of details and cool lifestyle photos. And that helped hugely.
Nice.
And then from there, they add to cart, get there, it's cool. The relationship could stop there. Because then we've got, most people are not going to purchase your product on the first go. Even if really, let's say the world's most optimized store has a 10% conversion rate. Okay, that means for every one person who buys, 9 people didn't, right? And that would be extraordinary if you had that kind of conversion rate.
Oh, yeah.
So the trick around that is to increase touch points. So most stores, let's say it's a more inexpensive product, say $50, they're going to need 3 to 4 touch points before they purchase from you. The familiarity, frequency builds trust, builds confidence in the store. And most people are not just going to impulse purchase something. And if you've got a more expensive product, say $200, they're probably going to need to visit the site 5 to 8 times before they make a purchase decision. So we got to look for reasons to increase those touch points. Such an easy one. Remarketing. Oh my gosh. PPC ads can be, I will admit, an easy way to lose money. But if you're doing remarketing, then those are inexpensive because you're not really competing against too many other people now. And you're only showing the ads to people who raised their hand and said they're interested by visiting a product. So you do Facebook ads and Google Shopping ads with dynamic remarketing. Now you've got dynamic ads that you don't have to mess with that follow people around the web like a lost dog for 30 days, increasing those touch points, keeping you top of mind, reminding them that you exist, and keeping that product just one click away.
Yep. Yep. So we've talked a lot about, the things that people should be doing better, but who out there is doing it right? What companies are you paying attention to that are super awesome about conversion rate optimization?
Good question. This is one of my clients. I'm biased, of course. Working with them, we have done a lot of clever things together just to make the site so easy to use. I like a lot is lenosgarage.com. It's Jay Leno's car care detailing products. And it does all kinds of tiny little clever things to make it easy to shop. There's no growth hacking. There's no psychological manipulation. Ultimately, the way we increase the conversion rate there is just make the site easy to use, right? So a clever trick I like is, if you go to an empty shopping cart on a site, usually it just says your cart is empty and that's it. What am I going to do with that? So if you go to Leno's page with the cart empty.
Right. It's shaming you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, your cart is empty.
Your cart's empty. No, this one doesn't do that. It gives you, hey, here's the three top categories. So if you wanted to go hey, sorry, your cart's empty. I browse these products instead. That I rarely see that optimization done, which blows my mind, but it's such an easy thing to do. So we do that. And then when you hit the cart, if you hit the cart page with products, you'll notice the footer, several elements that were competing calls to action disappear out of the footer. What's strange is when I see supposedly optimized stores carts normally is like the cart gets huge and bloated with all kinds of weird widgets that I don't understand. Now, just make like one of the easiest conversion rate optimization tricks is start taking stuff away. Like a lot of times there's a lot of cruft on sites. Just strip it down to the stuff people use. And that's where heat mapping can be valuable. As you can see, you know, don't look at the stuff people are clicking on. Look at the stuff that doesn't get clicked on and then go, well, why is it here? Why do we even have this? And then strip that stuff out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's super important because once you've gotten somebody to take some action, you kind of want to continue to focus them down to get them to complete that action. Like this is why carts get abandoned on sites. Cause usually I like to think of it as a carnival and they just leave all the distractions up and they're like, ooh, hey, there's the fun house over there. When all you really wanted to do was just get them on the roller coaster.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's like, so this is one that probably everybody does is they put the social share buttons on the product page. Listen, if someone wants to share your stuff, they know how to do it. They're going to do it. Like if I'm on my phone, I just click, like there's a button, I just click share. I don't need a silly share widget on your product page. And how many people are really going to do that? And does that even give us any value? Probably not. But what it does do is remind us, hey, why don't you go to Facebook and get back to stalking your ex-girlfriend, right? It's just it's a competing distraction. You've stuck an ad and link for social networks on your product page, the most important one to get people into the funnel. So I like, that's just an easy trick. Just pull that stuff out. Those are competing calls to action. You don't need it.
Right, right. So having done this for, you know, 7-8 years at this point, you know, you're aware of the marathon versus sprint distinction that everybody likes to apply to businesses. But, you know, from all the ones that you've actually seen in e-commerce businesses, what are the things that really separate, you know, the sprints from the marathons here, from flash in the pan or hobby to the ones that actually endure and make money?
That's a good question. So number one, approaching it in a risk-averse way tends to be successful. I've noticed like successful entrepreneurs, contrary to popular thinking, seem to be very risk-averse. And so you'll see them doing smart things. Like they come up with an idea and they love it, but then they go, okay, does anyone else love it? And can I find those people? So, and I think that's where you'll see people doing, you know, investing in Kickstarter. I think that that one makes sense a lot because it's reducing their risk or doing pre-sales in general. But Kickstarter, I love for e-commerce because you're going to, A, you validate it with a minimum of risk. If you've done it right, you also build a huge audience up front, which is very cool about Kickstarter. You're building that audience up front. And that's the next point. The enduring businesses focus on the customer lifetime value. You know, it's more than just, hey, let's get one purchase and funnel people in. Okay, that's cool. And that's how you should start. But once you have that dialed in, that process, now think about, okay, how do we extend the customer lifetime value both ways? Like, how do I give them more value after they've made the first purchase? And then how do I, as a business, get value in return? And always try to be thinking of it in those terms of like, give more value than you take. That will always lead to a positive relationship in everything, probably in all aspects of life.
Probably.
And that's where we see things, you know, that's where you see, you know, the benefit of like these longer, these segmented Facebook sales funnels that more people are starting to talk about that are very cool. Content marketing, of course, and email marketing automation in general, which brings me to my third point. In no way is email marketing dead. Like when social media started to rise
Preach! Yeah.
You know, when people got all excited, like, I got to get more Facebook likes. And like, who cares, right? We are still, everyone checks their email every day, multiple times a day. Only the most disciplined of people will not check it multiple times a day, right? So having that email list is so valuable. And that's the third point. People who focus on building a list and building engagement then with their audience through their list, their email list, and then, you know, subsequently social media, those I think are the three pillars where we see, I tend to see very successful businesses.
Yeah, yeah. So if somebody was to get started in e-commerce today, aside from building a list, which, you know, you just explained why that's super important, what are some other things that you would say that they would need to keep in mind to make that successful?
So, you know, I have seen, well, you know, looking at really successful entrepreneurs, like I've interviewed a bunch for my podcast, mostly on the Shopify platform, and there's really only like two ways they approach things. And number one, I think the most common, and I tend to attract these people, I think, so it's probably biased, is they have a pain or problem in their own life. And then one day, you know, it could be anything, like just some trivial annoyance in your life. It could be anything, you know, from something as silly as like, you know what? I want a not steel bracelet for my Rolex. Hey, could I do aromatherapy in my shower with my shower head? Like, these are all just things that seemed ridiculous until they turn into seven-figure businesses. So the person has like a real pain or problem in their own life that they go, you know what? I could do better. I could fix this. All right, that's like step one. You're your own best customer in this case. And then you say, you know, is there anyone else like me? Does anyone else care? And they go out and start building a list, building, pre-selling stuff. It's usually it's some kind of crowdfunding thing. And you can even do it in your own store. Just like sell pre-orders, have a progress bar. I like that idea so much. I have an app I built to do it called Crowdfunder. And then as a plug, ding. And, you know, the way that doesn't work well, and there are exceptions to this rule, of course, but the people who I see struggle just go, I want to start an e-commerce store. That's where they start from. Not with the pain or problem in their own life, but just, I want an online store as a business. Okay. But then they really struggle because it's like, they're overwhelmed in that, what do I sell? Well, man, there are unending people on Alibaba who will sell you anything. It's unbelievable. And then they struggle with it and they're not passionate about it. Now, there are exceptions to that rule, of course. You know, I interviewed a gentleman from a group called Gorilla Goodies, and that's all they do is they just throw ideas against the wall until they find one that sticks and grow it. And they do, he told me, and perfectly, no NDA here, perfectly fine. He said they did, it was $3 million in 7 months doing that approach.
Wow.
But it was like a constant thing where it's like, we launch a store, we run it, and then when the fad runs out, we just shut the store down and move on to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. And if it fails, no love lost. And that's probably another important like success metric. And I don't know when you say, all right, this isn't working. But oftentimes I see people just cling to stuff that's like, you've been running this business for 2 years. And sure, like stack the bricks, work on your business. But sometimes you got to go, maybe this just isn't a good idea and I need to pivot and try something else. I've pivoted several times in my business. I didn't start as a Shopify expert or even an e-commerce expert, right? And it, you know, we just kept going to the intersection of what, you know, what work was available and what made us happy. And we evolved and revised from there. And I've seen successful businesses do that. I mean, rarely is a business going to be look the same, you know, in terms of like revenue source from when they started to like 2 years later.
Right, right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense. Yeah. I was thinking when you brought up the stacking the bricks metaphor, I was thinking to myself, there's really two ways you can be stacking the bricks. You can stack the bricks in a way that creates a stable platform that your business can grow from. And then there's the other way, which is you can just stack the bricks on top of each other. And eventually you have a totally unstable tower on your hands. So the question is, do you recognize that that tower is becoming unstable or that you didn't build a real foundation underneath it? And how quickly do you do that? I think that's the you know, I'm clinging to this idea. I've stacked bricks, you know, I'm putting bricks on top of each other. That's great. But, you know, is this something that's going to be workable either for you? Is it a good business model? Does anybody else care? You know, that sort of stuff. So, yeah, you got to stack the bricks, but they should be the right bricks and they should be in the right configuration. So,
you know, it's hard. Hearing you say it like that, like it's so hard. But that's, I think, one important, and there's so many like mindset shifts you have to make to succeed as an entrepreneur. But probably one of the most valuable is give yourself permission to fail. If you treat like everything you do as an experiment, we would do oddball projects and we call them labs experiments. And that it was important because it gave us permission to fail where we weren't afraid. We didn't care. We're like, let's just learn from it. Let's see if it works or not. And twice these turned into like million visit AdSense sites that we created. One was Rainy Cafe, the other is Calming Manatee. They're both still up. But then those became lessons in PR and marketing. So I think that's an important point. Just don't be afraid of failing, because ultimately you're learning like a standard operating procedure for building a business, where even if you failed on the first one, then you could just go back and execute it three times as fast and try a different idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a fantastic way to look at it. When you cling super tightly to an idea, that's where you're, because of your fear of failure in there, that's where you're going to end up just like creating yourself and your business into the ground because you don't know when to let go.
Yeah. And I think, so this is, I don't know that there's any way to prove this other than asking, and I never have. It would be rude. But with clients who like, you're building a new store for them and they don't want to launch it. They just revise the thing to death. And like after it's like ready to go, it looks better than their current site or it looks great. Yeah. And they just keep revising it. I've begun to wonder, like, is it just that they're afraid of it failing, of it possibly failing when they launch it, and they're just postponing, you know, facing the reality of it by revising it endlessly? And I'm like, in no way am I ever going to ask anyone that. In some cases, that may be what's going on subconsciously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also true of people that are just starting up web businesses in general, where they, you know, they stay so focused into the code, or they keep adding the next feature, and they never actually push it out to the audience and say, what do you think? Because they're afraid that if they come back and say, you know what, this sucks. They don't want to hear that, you know? That's damaging to their ego, and then suddenly they're going to feel like it's a failure instead of taking that as a learning moment. Oh, well, why does it suck? Like, what did I miss? You know, what do you need? What is it that you're doing? You know, what problems are you having? So there's a healthy and a not so healthy way to look at that for sure.
No, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So e-commerce has changed so much in the last 3 to 5 years. You know, the WooCommerce has taken a huge upswing. Shopify is now blowing the doors off of their post-IPO stock price, and they're kicking ass and taking names every quarter. And, you know, Magento is struggling, moving from M1 to M2 and getting everybody out there. You know, what do you see happening with the e-commerce world in general in the next 12 months? Do you see any big shakeups coming?
Good question. So yeah, I think we're at a point like when we started down the e-commerce path and the web design path in general, say 4 years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, it was always a big discussion as to like, what platform should I use? And like almost every time someone would go, well, we looked at these platforms and there would be like a new one I'd never heard of. And now it feels like we have gotten rid of a lot of those players. Like I never hear about Volusion anymore. You know, Lemon Stand had a good run. I don't hear about that anymore. Now it feels like, you know, Shopify and BigCommerce in the hosted space. And then for open source, you know, Magento and WooCommerce. So it's like there's definitely there are fewer platforms. And it's good and bad. Like you don't want a monoculture, but we still have enough competition to drive innovation. But I like having these small, you know, the fewer platforms because it helps build communities around them. And I think that's where the real value comes. I know, like for us, in particular on Shopify, my favorite feature is the community that they built around it. And like, it was really a very concerted effort to create. To create, you know, an ecosystem around it of partners and experts and people willing to help. And I think that has been hugely beneficial to the platform's growth. WordPress has always been like that a little bit because WooCommerce, you know, because they're open source.
Oh yeah.
But as far as like, you know, future shakeups, I hear a ton, and I think they're overrated. I hear a ton about like AI and chatbots.
Yeah.
So like AI in general, I've yet to see anything really cool come out of it. I think it'll happen. I doubt it's in the next 12 months. Chatbots, after hearing a ton about them 12 months ago and seeing nothing, I have just recently started to see some cool chatbots going, where we see people using like Facebook Messenger instead of live chat on their store. But probably like personalization, better segmentation. That's the thing. That's the low-hanging fruit that I'd like to see on websites. Like, you know, 3 years ago, we were just trying to figure out like, oh man, how are we going to make a site look good on a phone, a tablet, and a desktop? Like that was our big worry. Okay, well, we figured that out now, right? Responsive design won that war and sorted it out. So what's next? Well, I think it's building more personal experiences for people.
Yeah, yeah.
And really that's like, we obsess about like bots and AI. Well, that's a technology. Who cares? What's the end benefit? Why are we excited about that? Well, it's because we can automate personalization,
right,
and recommendations and segmentation. And I think that's what's happening. That's why people are excited about it.
Yeah, we all want personalization, but nobody can afford what it costs to get humans to deliver that. So, and to deal with all the other stuff around it, like training and consistency. But a bot, you know, they've got all of that wired. But then making them actually personable and personal is a huge thing.
And the other thing that's cool is like the democratization of technology, you know, where this used to be a really expensive thing to do. And like properly hosting a Magento enterprise solution was like 10 grand a month. I mean, it was nuts. Where now, you know, you've got Shopify, even their most expensive enterprise offering is 2 grand a month, give or take. And their starting platform for selling online is $30 a month. And like Facebook ads, you could start those for $5 a day. and like even, you know, cool email marketing automation platforms that used to be totally inaccessible to anyone but enterprises 5 years ago. And I've got all these amazing tools that are really inexpensive. Like in my own business, I used Drip for $100 a month. I mean, the stuff is phenomenal, the tools we have access to.
Right, right. Yeah, that pace is doesn't seem to be slowing down either, which I like as well.
What's an exciting tool you're looking at that's coming up?
Well, I use a lot of the same tools that you do, but the one that I am kind of excited about right now, which kind of came about from conversations that Brendan's been having for years. So, you know, Brendan Dunn of Double Your Freelancing, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So he's working on something called rightmessage.io.
I was going to bring up rightmessage. Yeah.
So I think
I'm very excited about this.
This personalization like excites me to no end because I see what Brendan does on his own site and he talks about it on his tweet streams and he blogs about it. And I'm looking at how he's going through all of this stuff and it's amazing. But it's like, you know, it's kind of manual intensive. So now the fact that he's come up with this tool that can completely automate this and give that I can install it on my site eventually, it's not quite there yet. He's still in beta, but that I can put that on my site with a JavaScript snippet and get that level of personalization really, really has me jazzed. Like, I can't wait to see where this thing is in 6 to 12 months.
Yeah. So to put it in context, like I use for my email marketing, I use Drip. So let's say someone visits a particular service offering on my website in Drip, I'll tag them and say like, you know, Facebook ads or like visited Facebook ads. So then I know, okay, that's a thing this person is interested in. I can give them content around that. They essentially raise their hand and said, I'm interested in this. What RightMessage would do is then change content on the website based on those tags, based on users' behavior. So they're getting a personalized experience. And like, it's just tags in a CRM basically and JavaScript swapping out HTML, nothing too complicated about it. But to do this in the past was a big pain. Like if you did not have front-end development skills, there's no way you got it done. And it sounds like RightMessage is the solution for, you know, marketers who are technically savvy but don't want to do code.
Right, right.
That was my feeling about it. That's what I'm hoping for anyway.
Yeah. So when that comes out and the fact that we'll be able to, you know, change titles and alter calls to action and really target that person so that you can say, you know, start now as opposed to start your freelancing business now. When you're talking to somebody who's interested specifically in freelancing, you know, you can basically make your website scream, I know about you, I know about your problem. So that level of personalization has me pretty jazzed for sure.
Yeah. And there's in no way should anyone consider that like scammy or sleazy or growth hacky. It is good customer service. You're giving someone a personalized, segmented experience.
Yeah, yeah. And if you don't believe me, just go to doubleyourfreelancing.com and see how Brendan's site actually responds to you as you click on different things and how the emails that come to you actually get changed and targeted differently. So it's very eye-opening to see what that can be.
Yeah, if you go there, he knows you're a freelancer, but there's different, like a developer is different than a designer, is totally different than like a copy editor, right? So he's done what you'll see it do is try and kind of figure out who you are and then change up the content and the language so it's relevant to you.
Right, and recommend more things that you would be interested in as opposed to jamming content that you don't really care about.
Yeah, get rid of that stuff I don't care about.
Yeah, yeah. Cool, well, thanks so much for being on here today, Kurt. I appreciate all of your insight and your time here. Any parting thoughts here or ways that people can reach you for further information or if they want to chat with you about your services on Shopify?
Sure. So three things. I mean, if you're like, hey, let's work together on Shopify, go check out ethercycle.com. Ether is in Ethernet, cycle is in bicycle. And that's my consultancy. Tons of free resources up there, free email guide, a free like email course and guides and just lots of great stuff. Click that resources tab, check it out. Or if you want to get in touch with me, just want to ask me a question or say, you know, you're like, hey, Kurt, I think you have cool hair. Yeah, whatever. Go to KurtElster.com. You want my email address? That's how you get it. Give me yours first. Sign up for my newsletter and then just reply to the first email you get. You can unsubscribe. I don't care. But anyone who has ever sent me a thoughtful email will get a thoughtful response back. And then lastly, it sounds like you've got a lot of your audience is freelancers. I wrote a book, I love it, called Email Templates for Freelancers. It is just it's the templates I was using in my own business as I was growing it. You can get, I'll give you the link so you can put it in the show notes. And if you use coupon code ROGUE, we could do 20%.
Yeah.
Sound good?
That sounds great. That's awesome. Thanks, Kurt. And if anybody has any further comments or questions about conversion rate optimization that you want us to chat about on further episodes of the podcast, or follow-ups you'd like us to ask Kurt, you can send us an email, podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you've got a minute, leave us a review in iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and we'll talk to you next week.
And that's our episode for this week. If you have any questions or comments, please let us know at podcast@roguestartups.com. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Rogue Startups. And be sure to visit roguestartups.com for full show notes on each episode. If you're enjoying the show, we'd sure appreciate a review in iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.